obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name is Corey Long. I'm a very grateful, enthusiastic member of Al-Anon. Hi. I've got my watch up there. I've got the time I've started. I'm incredibly nervous. I don't know if this will make any difference to me, but at least I've got it. I want to thank the committee for inviting my husband and I to come and be with you this weekend. I want to thank Kathy and Kurt for being fantastic hosts. I'm a little nervous. Larsine is sitting with my husband over there. That looks like trouble to me. I'm very overwhelmed, first off, with the size of this conference and the love and the joy that is being shared at this conference in Southern California, because there's so much incredible recovery here. And I'm from Wetumpka, Alabama, and a lot of the stuff I've learned about Al-Anon, I've learned through tapes and listened to CDs, and people that I admire and I respect are from Southern California. I was at the Longtimers tea yesterday, and people were mentioning Winnie Eddy, and I adore Winnie Eddy, and I never met Winnie Eddy, but I've listened to a number of her CDs and her tapes, and I pass them along to the men and the women that I sponsor, because I think that's what we do here, is we share our experience, strength, and hope, and it doesn't matter if they're no longer with us physically, they're with us spiritually. And my friend Jack, that I met 2 years ago in Nashville, Tennessee, has come to be here. And Kathy, who I met last year, and I'd met Larsine a few years ago in Alabama. And when I got here, our lives were this big. We had nobody in our family. I mean, we had nobody in our lives besides each other. And my social life consisted of coming home from work and sitting on the couch and watching him in the armchair in case he did something exciting. And God love him, he'd been drinking, and so there wasn't a lot of excitement, but at least I knew where he was. And now I come here and I see all of these people, and you've been so welcoming, and so I know that God's going to show up here in a minute, and when he does, you'll know, because I'll start talking even faster than I talk now. But I'm very grateful to be here. I love Al-Anon, I love AA, and I had no idea this is where my life was going to take. I had no idea that this was the plan God had for me. I got here on my 2-month wedding anniversary. I had waited almost 36 years to meet and marry the perfect man. He was a raging alcoholic when I did it. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with me when I got here. All I wanted was for him to not drink as much. I didn't even want him to quit drinking. I just wanted him to not drink as much. If you're doing the math, we got here on September 18th, 1998, together, because when we married, he and I ceased to be individuals and we became a we, and we needed to do everything together. God willing, in 2 weeks, my husband and I will celebrate 15 years of wedded bliss, and in 2 months, we'll celebrate 15 years in recovery. And that was not my plan when I got here. We got here because the week before he went to treatment, we went to a place outside of Montgomery called Callaway Gardens. It's about an hour from us, and we were going to go play putt-putt, and we were going to look at the azaleas, and it was just going to be a fabulously wonderful day. And I knew nothing about the disease of alcoholism when I got here. I don't believe I grew up in the family disease of alcoholism, but I don't think that matters, because I know that today I am profoundly and deeply affected by the disease of alcoholism. And I know today that I would be destined to either be in love with, married to, or chasing after an alcoholic, because I think alcoholics are fabulously fun people. They're exciting. They're unpredictable. They're usually pretty funny, and at times they can be terrifying. But most of the time, if they're actively in the midst of the disease, they need me, and that's what's really important to me. And you're going to hear a lot of stuff from me that may sound familiar from people from Southern California, because when I've heard something that resonates with me, I hold on to it, because that's how I learn about the program of Al-Anon. So a week before we got here, my husband and I had gone to this place called Callaway Gardens, and we were going to play putt-putt golf, and we weren't there 10 minutes. And I know today that he was restless, irritable, and discontented. I did not know that when I got here. I thought he was just being really cranky. And we were there about 10 minutes, and I just looked at him. I don't know why I said this. I said, do we need to leave? And he said, yes, we do. And I said, okay. So we got in the car, and as we were leaving, we were passing a gas station. I said, do we need to stop and buy you beer? And if I had thought he was restless, irritable, and discontented before then, he was just insanely rageful at that point, but he didn't actually say anything. You could just almost see the steam coming out of his head. And I thought, this is not good. And so I didn't say anything to him. He said, no, you do not need to buy me beer. And I thought, okay, back away from the crazy man. And so he didn't say anything to me. I didn't say anything to him. And we didn't talk about it because we don't talk about things in my family. We didn't talk about it. If I don't want to see it, I'm not going to see it. I'm just going to pretend it's not there. He just got up on the wrong side of the bed. It's not that big of a deal. 4 days later, Kent and I never argued about anything, really. And 4 days later, we got into an argument about something. I can't tell you what it was. But I stormed out of the house. I had a professional obligation I had to go to. I stormed out of the house. He stayed in the house. And on the way back from this professional obligation, I heard a voice in my head say, as clear as a bell, you need to go to Al-Anon. I have no idea what Al-Anon is. If I don't know what it is, I'm not going to pay any attention to it. And so I was like, whatever. I completely disregarded this. And got home, and about 10 o'clock that night, my husband Kent is sitting right over there. And he actually does exist, and he's just cute as a button. And he said to me, I can't stop drinking without help. And I said, yes, let me help. I am really good at helping. Because, you know, I don't need to hear those three little words, I love you. I need to hear those three little words, I need you. I can make you love me after that, but if you need me, you are not going to get rid of me. That's my thinking. And so I was all about that. So I'm up at 10 o'clock at night getting at the Blue Cross Blue Shield brochure because I know where that is. I've got it filed. And, you know, what do we need to do and where do we need to take him? And we checked him into treatment on September 18th, 1998. And this is as clueless as I was. I had no idea they were going to keep him. I don't know what I thought they were going to do to him. Talk to him, you know, say, don't drink, be a good boy. I don't know what I thought they were going to do, but I had no idea they were going to actually keep him. So we took him to this treatment center in Montgomery, Alabama, and this is where I discovered my very first resentment when I got here. The intake nurse started asking him questions. You know, what is your name? And he'd give his name, and then I'd give his name. What's your birthday? And then he'd give his birthday, and I'd give his birthday. How much do you drink every night? And I said 8 beers, and he said 18. And before I could whip around on him on the 18 beers, she said to me, what are you, his mother? And I was insulted. I was absolutely offended by that because I'd been married 2 months. I'm a newlywed. Do I look like I'm that old? And apparently I did look pretty bad. We actually keep a picture from that time on the bathroom mirror, so we remember what we looked like back then. It was not pretty. But I was insulted that she would you know, be so rude to me. And then she promptly escorted me out of the intake office and sent me to the family counselor. I'm like, there is nothing wrong with me. I look really good compared to an active alcoholic. Put me up next to a normal person, I'm not looking so good. But next to him, I look really good. So they sent me to this family counselor, and she took one look at me, and she actually goes to a meeting that I go to now. And her name is Miss Martha. And Miss Martha's got the perfectly white hair. You all, if you are ever been in the South, you've met a Miss Martha. She's got perfectly white hair. She's got the jewelry. The nails are done. The pedicure's done, the whole bit. And she took one look at me, and she said, honey, if you love him, you will go to Al-Anon. And I thought, well, how dare you suggest I don't love him? I've just married him, for God's sakes. Fine, I'll go to Al-Anon. I had no idea what it was. I left there, and I got online to an online meeting. And I'm so very grateful that people on that online meeting were patient, tolerant, and kind to me, because I have no recollection of what was going on at that meeting, except for the fact I kept getting this response to anything I was typing. You need to find a meeting in person. You need to find a meeting in person. And I'm sure it's because I was probably interrupting everybody asking questions. But the other thing that Martha had said to me was, I know today that I have a disease. The family disease of alcoholism affects my hearing. I don't always hear what's said, and I oftentimes hear things that are not said. And what I heard Martha say to me is, if you want to see him tomorrow, you have to go to the Al-Anon meeting. And I'm fine, I'll go to the Al-Anon meeting, whatever. And so I showed up this Al-Anon meeting at the treatment center. There were three little old ladies there. And at the time, I was 35 years old. I think, to me, the average age of these three women appeared to be 103 if they were a day. They had the little blue hair, and I have no idea what they said, but I can tell you what I heard. What I heard them say to me was, oh, honey, he'll drink again. They all drink again. And I burst into tears because I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing if he's going to drink again? Why are we here? What is the point of this? And they had the 12 steps and the 12 traditions on the wall, and they were AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions. I didn't know that, but I'm thinking, okay, 12 steps, 12 days, this can't be that difficult. And somewhere along in that meeting, someplace, they mentioned literature. Well, I'm all about the literature. You know, I have 7 years of a higher education. And that's really important because it doesn't matter how well-educated you are. I have a friend in Alabama who says, it doesn't matter how well-educated you are, you can still have a Jerry Springer life. I had 7 years of a higher education, and they said, literature. Give me a book. If I've got a book, I can find the answers. And so I bought within a week, I had every piece of literature that Al-Anon had published at that point of time. I had it in a canvas bag, and I was carrying it with me everywhere because I knew my answers were in the book. The only problem was I was asking the wrong questions. The questions I was asking was, what is wrong with him? Why does he have to drink? And I'm so very, very grateful that people were tolerant enough with me and patient enough with me to say, honey, just keep coming back. And what ended up happening to us right off the bat was 4 days into it, my husband came home. Well, first off, I always like to share this because Martha just laughs every time she thinks about it. He went to the family counselor at treatment and said, there are some things I need to say to Corey. I need to tell Corey. And she looked at him and she said, oh, honey, if you must, go with God. And so he came home 4 days into this deal, okay? 4 days into this deal, and he says, I need to be rigorously honest with you. Not ever a good start to a conversation. And he said, I am not a college graduate. And that was very important to me. I am not a college graduate. I dropped out to join the Army. Well, I knew he'd been in the Army. He said, I did not get an early out from the military. And there was not a $25,000 early out check in a bank account in Northern Virginia. The money was very important to me, too. I'd never seen any evidence of it, but I believed him when he said that he had it. I did not voluntarily leave the military. I got kicked out for alcohol rehabilitation failure. This is not my first treatment center. It's my third, and one of them was a year long. Yeah, I know. Imagine my surprise. I married 2 months. We're 4 days into this recovery. And this is what I get hit with. Now, he will tell you whenever he talks, he'll tell you that was the first time he was willing to be honest and open with anybody about anything. I had no idea what to do. But apparently, I'm built for endurance, not speed. And it never crossed my mind. It never occurred to me to leave him. But I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was up all night. He slept like a baby. And that's a second resentment, just FYI. And I cried all night. I had no idea. But here's my idea. These are ideas that I think up. Information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me, and then I act upon it. I'd made up in my head. I'd said to Kent before we married, I'd be a widow before as a divorcee. And he said, okay. And about 10 seconds later, he said, hey, that means I have to be dead. And I said, yes, it does. And the really sad thing about that is I was willing to wish this man that I absolutely adored dead instead of being divorced because it was all about how I would look. What would you think of me that he would divorce me? What would you think of me that he'd rather not be with me? And I'd rather wish him dead than have you all think badly of me. That's how sick I was when I got here. And so so there was no thought of me ever leaving. I'd made my bed. I was going to sleep in it. I would figure out how to make this work one way or the other because I'm really good at figuring things out. And he went to the treatment center the next day on Wednesday morning and told his counselor everything he told me. He had not told them that yet. And I'll be forever grateful to that treatment center because the man that he happened to speak to was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And what he said to my husband was, you need to go to AA. And sent him to a place called North California Street, the sole purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous, on Wednesday night, 5 days into this deal. And my husband came home that night. And he looked at me and he said, I have to go to a meeting a day for a year. Because apparently he'd told some guy he was willing to do 90-90. And the guy said to him, well, good for you, Skippy. Are you willing to go to a meeting a day for a year? And my husband said yes. And he said yes without talking to me, which I thought was, you know, just rude. But he said yes. He came home and he said, I need to go to a meeting a day for a year. And being the spiritual giantess I was, I said, and I hope there are no children here, I said, well, what the hell am I supposed to do? And he said, I think you should do an Al-Anon what I do in AA. They're the same program. And that began what I used to say was the year-long process of my husband sponsoring me in Al-Anon, but it was really only about 6 months. It just felt like a year. And I will tell you this, if you are contemplating sponsoring your loved one in Al-Anon, I would highly suggest you don't do it, because that's the only time I really contemplated homicide. Because he was making me crazy, more crazy than I already was. And what happened to us was he got this guy as a sponsor, and the guy gave him this little sticker to put on the bathroom mirror that said, you were looking at the problem. And for about 6 months, I thought, God, that is so good for Kent. Every morning, every evening, he'd look at that sticker that said, you were looking at the problem. And it took me about 6 months to realize, oh, crap, it's me. It's me. It's me. It's me. It's me. I did not do anything in the program for 6 months because I was so busy focused on him. I don't know where it came from. I don't know why it is. It's just the way that I'd always been, as long as I can remember. Like I said, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home, but I always thought that I was not enough. I am one of four children. I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger sister. I was the third born. My mother is English, my father was Dutch. I spent most of my life growing up overseas. And my father told the story one time years ago about how I came about with my name. And they had a son, they had a daughter, they just assumed I would be a boy. And turns out I was a girl, and so they named me Corey after my father and Patricia after my mother. And all I remember from that conversation was they wanted a boy and they got me instead. And information from nowhere, I made up in my head that I was not enough to them. I made up in my head that I did not measure up and that I was a disappointment to them. They never said that. Nobody ever said that. But that's information that I made up and that I acted on for the next 35 years until I got to Al-Anon. I'm so grateful that Al-Anon has given me a way to change the way I look at the past. I cannot change any of my events in the past, but I can change how I look at them. And what I can look at today is my father passed away before we got into the program. And anytime somebody calls my name, I think of my dad. And that's a gift. And that's a gift that Al-Anon gave me, is I have a way to look back at my past and not regret it, and to change how I look at things. I'd like to tell you that Kent was my first alcoholic. I think that makes me look a little smarter. But he was not. Nobody's really shocked by that. When I was 11 years old, my parents came home and said we were moving to Liberia, West Africa, and they were going to send us to boarding school in Holland. And what my brain did with that information was it said, see, you're not enough. If you were, they wouldn't be moving there, and you wouldn't be going to boarding school in Holland. And that's where I know the family disease of alcoholism affects me, and I don't even drink, because that selfishness and that self-centeredness that they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is me. It was all about me. It never occurred to me that it would be difficult for my parents to send their three oldest children away to boarding school. It never occurred to me that they must have struggled tremendously with that decision and loved us enough to want to give us a good education. None of that came until I got into Al-Anon and I did the work that is described for us in our program. And the work for me is working the 12 steps of Al-Anon to the best of my ability so that I have a spiritual awakening and I am able to get out of myself and realize what a gift it was that my parents gave me to allow me to go to this boarding school. But what ended up happening at the boarding school was I was crying myself to sleep every night. I was 11 years old. I was the smallest kid on campus. I was a goofy looking kid. I used to wear my glasses over my hair and I loved to match plaids. The only reason I look halfway decently put together today is I've got women in Al-Anon and AA that will take me shopping because I didn't know how to dress when I got here. And I went to this boarding school, and I have an older sister, and I don't know what she said to me, but what I heard her say after about 2 weeks was she came downstairs to my room. I was put in a room with four Dutch girls who spoke no English and me who spoke no Dutch. And what I heard her say to me was, I hear you're crying yourself to sleep every night. And I thought, mind reading is a defect of character I didn't know I had until I got here, I thought she was going to say, it'll be okay, honey. And that's not what I heard her say. What I heard her say was, you're embarrassing me. If you keep crying, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And I don't know if that's what she said or not, but that's what I heard. And so that's what I acted upon. And I started stuffing my feelings. And I'd be whoever you wanted me to be so I could fit in. And I never felt like I fit in because I was the youngest kid. I was a goofy kid. I just never felt like I fit in. And so then I escaped into books. And I'm a voracious reader. I'd read whatever I get my hands on because it was always better to be anybody else, anyplace else, than right here, right now. Did not want to be me. My parents came back to the States after 2 years. I said, I want to come home. We came home. We were here 6 months, and I didn't fit in Dunwoody, Georgia. We moved to Dunwoody, Georgia, didn't fit in there, and I was sure it was because all of these Georgian rubes did not appreciate my sophistication because I'd been overseas. And so when my dad came home and said we were moving to the Philippines, I was all for it. I know today that's a geographic cure for me, because if I go there, things will be different. The problem is, if I go there, there I'll be. And there I was. And we got to the Philippines, and I loved it. For the first time ever, nobody knew my older brother. Nobody knew my older sister. My little sister is 10 years younger than me, and I could be me. There's only one problem with that. By the time I got to the Philippines when I was 14 years old, I had no idea who I was. I had absolutely no sense of self, and I don't even drink. And I don't know how that happened, except that internal spiritual malady we talk about, that seeking of God, there was something missing in me. And I started looking for people to fill it. Alcohol doesn't do for me what it does for my husband or what it does for alcoholics, but people do for me what alcohol does for them. And I'll try and fill that void in me with you. We spent 2.5 years in the Philippines, and we moved to Singapore. And I was thrilled to move to, I was not thrilled to move to Singapore because I was going to be a senior in high school. And my dad came home and said, we're moving. I said, I'm going to be a senior. He said, yes, I understand that. We're moving. I said, we can't move. We're moving. We can't move. And of course, we moved. And I was livid about that. But I can look back now and know that's God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because you see, when I moved to Singapore in the fall of 1979, I met the man who was to become my husband in 1998. And I don't know how that happens, except God's in charge. And Kent was the student body president. He was voted most sparkling personality. He was the king of the junior-senior prom. He was big man on campus. And I was the new kid on campus. And I did what I needed to do to fit in. And it was a hard year. He was involved with somebody else. I was trying to date. I don't know how to date because I'm instantly in love. You know, all you have to do is look at me right, and I'm in love. And so we spent that year, and we spent that year in Singapore. And the only night that Kent and I ever went out was the night we graduated from high school on June 10th, 1980. And we went to a party at the Warrens' house. They lived in Holland Village. There was a bathtub full of Budweiser beer. You see, I remember every moment of that evening. My husband remembers not a single second of it. It should have been a clue. Whew, right over my head. And I came back to the States to go to college, and I did a year in Maine because I thought snow would be pretty, and it was for the first time it snowed, and it didn't melt again until May. But what happened in that at that college was, I believe I was exposed for the first time to the active disease of alcoholism, because I picked a guy who was drinking vodka every night, and I thought that was sophisticated, and because I have a progressive disease. I need you to need me, and the more you need me, the more I need you to need me, and I get very needy. And of course, if you're an active alcoholic, you're going to, and probably any normal person would as well, you're going to back away from the really, really needy woman. And of course, he broke up with me, and I could not stay on that campus because I was sure everybody on that campus knew that this guy had dumped me, so I had to move. And so I moved down to Emory University in Dunwoody, in Atlanta, Georgia, and I got to the guidance counselor there, and they said, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I want to be a lawyer. And she said, not with those grades, you won't. And so I do what I know to do, is I put my nose to the wheel, I put my shoulder to the grindstone, whatever the sayings are, and I work my butt off. And in 3 years, I graduated from college with honors. And that's a great way to get through college. It's an awful way to try and deal with the disease of alcoholism, but I took those lessons of, if you work really, really hard, you can make anything happen. And that's true pretty much in any environment except when you're living with the active disease of alcoholism. I took a job. I took a year off. I went to law school. I graduated from law school, and I took a job in Montgomery, Alabama. I was going to be there for 2 years. 25 years later, you see, I'm built for endurance, not speed. I'm still in Montgomery, Alabama. But the reason I stayed in Montgomery was because 6 months before I was supposed to leave, I met him. And he was really, really tall, and I liked that. And I met him at a charity softball game, and I thought he was socially conscious. And, I had all these ideas of what was important. We went to the after the charity softball game party, and he asked for my number, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's so gallant. And I left. I went home. I'm a responsible girl. I love what Larsine says about rules and regulations. I am a rules and regulation girl, and I have to be home at a certain time because I have to get up and go to work the next morning. And this guy calls me on the phone and says, look, I need to get up and go to work in the morning, but the party is still going on. Can I sleep on your couch? And I thought, oh, and he's responsible, and he's got employment. This is fantastic. And I don't date. I'm in love. And so he came and slept on my couch that night, and that was the only night in the next 2.5 years that he slept on my couch. But he did sleep on the couch that night because I'm instantly in love. And his drinking bothered me, and his drinking bothered me from the beginning. And like I said, I have 7 years of a higher education. It never once occurred to me to stop to talk to him when he was not actually drinking. I would sit there and wait until he had like maybe 6, 7, 8 beers. Yeah, see, shaking the head in the background, never occurred to me. 8 beers would be like the perfect time to talk to him about why his drinking was a problem. Yeah, I know. I mean, the insanity of my thinking. We have a saying in my neck of the woods, my brain is not my friend. Because I'm thinking this is the perfect time to talk. He's got enough of a buzz on. He's going to be enough of a good mood that he's going to understand. I can explain it to him. And he's going to say, oh, yes, you're right. I'll stop. Or, yes, we'll do it your way. Yeah, it never, ever happens that way. Even today, almost 15 years sober, it doesn't happen that way. But that's where I started getting really, really, really sick behind the drinking, because all I could focus on was what he was doing, what he was drinking. And I couldn't look at reality as it was. I mean, he would call me from 4 o'clock in the morning at the dog track telling me he had taken $400 out of the checking account to gamble. And my brain would say, God, he's so responsible. I'm so glad he called. Never occurred to me to question why he's at the dog track at 4 o'clock in the morning. Never thought to say, you know, that's the rent money. But I have to justify, rationalize, and defend, because I cannot look at what I cannot look at. A couple of examples of just how sick I got behind the disease of alcoholism. He never hit me. But there was a lot of verbal abuse, and there was a lot of flying things in the house. Beer cans was the main projectile target. Primarily because I didn't know how to keep my mouth shut. I was constitutionally incapable of not explaining to him why he needed to not do whatever it was he was doing. But I'm really smart, and I will think up a solution. And it's really not my problems that are my problem. It's my solutions to my problem that are my problem. Because I would think of these great solutions in my head. And one of the things I thought about doing was I like to take pictures, and I took a photograph of his son. Now, we're in Alabama in the fall. It's football season, so he's got a 3-year-old wearing an Alabama jersey, an Alabama football in the leaves. It was a fabulous photograph. And I blow that sucker up. I don't blow it up to 5x7 or 8x10 like apparently normal people. I blow it up by 16x20, poster size. I hang it on the wall directly across the street, across the hall or the living room from his drinking chair. I stand in front of it like I'm Vanna White and say to him, if you do not love your son enough to quit drinking, or if you don't love me enough to quit drinking, perhaps you love your son enough to quit drinking. And that's when the beer cans started flying. And I didn't understand that. And I thought, okay, I clearly did not explain this to him at the right time, in the right chair, when he was in the right mood, when he had just the right amount to drink. And so I kept trying to do things like that. Because I have a progressive disease, I am convinced that he will not stay with me if I do not purchase things for him. So I gave him a gold credit card. Now I will, yeah. See, there's some identification floating around out there. Much to my husband's chagrin, Al-Anon has really helped me a lot with that. So he doesn't. Early on, he didn't get a lot of credit cards. But I gave this guy a gold credit card, and he used to like to purchase weapons with it. And I don't understand what is it with the men that I'm attracted to, who like to drink and purchase weapons. But there it is. And he came home one afternoon with a sawed-off shotgun that he gotten at the pawn shop with beer. And, of course, I picked that moment to discuss with him why it was inappropriate for him to be purchasing the shotgun and drinking at the same time with my credit card. Thank you very much. And that conversation didn't go the way that I wanted it to go. What ended up happening was he locked himself in the bathroom and threatened to kill himself. And I spent an hour and a half on one side of that door trying to talk him out of killing himself. And because I'm incredibly good at what I do, I was successful in that. But the really important thing about that story for me is it really wasn't about him. It was really about me. I could not stand the thought that he would kill himself rather than be with me. So I was going to do whatever it took, because I have never, ever voluntarily left a relationship on my own until I came to Al-Anon. Everybody I've ever been involved with has left me, which is no surprise now that I know about the disease of alcoholism. But it was very, very important to me, and I did everything I needed to do to talk this guy out of the bathroom. And he came out of the bathroom, and you would have thought that that would have had a moment of clarity for me, but I did not. I stayed in that relationship for another 8 to 10 months. And what happened was we were living in Montgomery. He took a job in Birmingham, which is about 2 hours from us. He got an apartment in Birmingham. I was paying for the apartment in Birmingham. I was paying for the apartment in Montgomery because, you see, you must need me. He had told me the reason he had financial difficulties was because the first wife was a witch, and that was not the word he used. And she had taken all of his money. I know today that a lot of that stuff probably had to do with alcoholism. And I was living in Birmingham. I had an apartment in Montgomery so that you would know that I was living in Birmingham. I was driving to work 2 hours every way, each way, which may not be a big thing in L.A., but that's huge in Alabama. He said to me, if you love me, you'll buy a house.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I may have gone for it if he had not picked the house next door to his parents. And I said no. And so then he found another house, and I don't know why I said no, but I said no. And he stormed out of the apartment, and I stayed. And I stayed up all night waiting for him, and I was looking for him on the phone, and he wasn't answering me. And he came home the next morning, and he said, I think I need some space and time. And I don't know where this came from except God. I said, take all the space and time you want. This ship just sailed. And I packed up my stuff, and I moved to Montgomery to the apartment that I had. Now, I'd like to tell you that I was able to maintain that and that I'd let him go, and it was okay. And the truth of the matter is I then stalked him for a couple of months. And these were some of my defects of character come out. I'm apparently very vengeful, and I will get mine. I don't suffer well. I don't suffer silently. I'm certainly not suffering alone. And he came to me. I made a decision that he owed me X amount of dollars based on the credit card that I had given him, and I made a decision that he was going to pay me the amount that I thought he owed me. And bless his heart, I know today that he was probably so guilt-ridden that he was willing to agree to anything I said. I drafted up a legally binding contract. I made him sign it, and I made him pay me every month for the next 3 years. When he said he couldn't pay me, and he, of course, he met and married somebody else within 6 months, and I was convinced that the reason he married her was because he didn't want to be married to me, and that was true, and I'm grateful today. And the only reason I didn't marry him was because he didn't ask. That's the only reason I didn't marry him. But that, again, is God doing for me what I can't do for myself. And I made that man pay me every month for the next 3 years, and if he called me and said, I can't afford to pay, I would say to him, if you don't pay me, I'm calling her, and I'm telling her all about us, because she had no idea. And he came up with the money. Yeah, I'm not proud of that, but that's where the disease of alcoholism takes me, and I don't even drink. So at the end of that relationship, I made a decision that I was never dating another man who didn't drink. So I found a man who had been sober in AA for 20 years, and I stalked him. And he would say things to me like, I don't drink. And I'd say, well, just have a glass of wine. That's not really drinking. He's like, it's alcohol. I'm like, no, it's wine. And this was 7 years of a higher education, and I don't have a clue about the disease of alcoholism. That relationship went nowhere. And what ended up happening was on February 1st, 1997, my husband found me on the internet. He will tell you he found me in the Wild Monkey Woman chat room, and I will tell him it doesn't look good for him when he says that. But the truth of the matter is, he found me on the high school bulletin board. And I know today that when I was in high school, I can look back on my past with rose-colored glasses, and I thought everything was so much better than it was where I was at that point in my life. And I'd put a message on the high school bulletin board. Anybody in the class of 1980, email me. And Kent, there were only 99 of us who'd graduated in our high school class, and he emailed me, and I emailed him, and he emailed me again. And I said, you know, screw this, call me. And I typed my phone number in, and I had surgery on my wrist, and typed the phone number in incorrectly. He had no idea where I was. He had no idea if I'd married. He had no idea how to find me. But what I know today is he spent an hour and a half on the phone that night typing numbers into the phone because he was having the same experience I was, in that the last time he felt good about himself was in high school. And eventually he found me at 9 o'clock on February 1st, 1997, and the first phone call was 11 and a half hours long. Yeah. Yeah, I know today that conversation went pretty much like me just talking to him every now and going, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. because that's sometimes what happens now. And I hung that phone up because, you know, I don't date. And I called my best girlfriend. I said, this is the man I'm going to marry. And I don't know if he knew it or not, but I certainly knew it. And that was February 1st. He didn't come to Montgomery until February 28th. He worked for the airlines. That's also God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. He could fly from D.C. to Montgomery for $20 or to Atlanta for $20. I'd pick him up in Atlanta. And that was the beginning. And I had no idea that was the beginning. What I said during the course of that conversation, I said two very important things. The first thing I said to him was, I want a man who doesn't drink. And he said, I don't drink much. And I said, well, how much is much? And he said, 6 or 8 beers a week. And the really important thing for me is that boundary that I had, that I wanted a man who didn't drink, went completely out the window as soon as I had a man. Didn't matter to me. And I said, that's not really drinking. And he said, I only drink beer. And we all know that alcoholics do not drink beer. They drink, you know, whiskey and Thunderbird and all sorts of other stuff. You cannot be an alcoholic if all you drink is beer. Information from nowhere. I make that up. I act upon it. The other thing I said at some point during the course of that conversation was, I said, yeah, but do you want me? And he said, yeah, I'm in. He's mine. I got him. And what ended up happening was, that was in February of 97, and my father called me in July of 97 and said, I'm not going through with you what I went through with your little sister, which was a date, wedding date on, wedding date off, wedding date on, wedding date off. He said, pick a date. So I picked my parents' 40th wedding anniversary to get married. And I called Kent and I said, hey, how do you feel about getting married on March 28th, 1998? And he said, okay. We had never talked about being married. He had never asked me to marry him. But you see, I'm a very quick learner. Nobody else had ever asked. By God, I'm asking this time. So I asked. He said, yeah. I didn't actually ask. I just told him. And about 15 minutes later, he called me back and he said, do you think I ought to get divorced first? Yeah, yes, I do. You see, what had happened was, I didn't know until we got here that when he went through that year-long treatment program in 1992, at the end of that program, he lasted about 18 months total with no alcohol. And at 6 months after that program, he started drinking again. He went home to his first wife and said, I'm leaving. And when he left, he left. And it never occurred to him to get any of the paperwork, never occurred to him to do any of the paperwork. He just left because he never thought he'd get married again. And so when I proposed to him, he also suggested perhaps a divorce would be in order. And of course, because I'm very good at what I do, I was planning a divorce on one hand and planning a wedding on the other. Because it never occurred to me to get the divorce first. And the reason for that was, I was sure that if I waited too long, I was going to lose him. So I had to do it both at the same time. Never occurred to me that that would be a problem. I always like to say that his first marriage, the divorce was final on February 18th. You have to wait 30 days in Alabama to get married. He could have gotten married March 18th. I had that man divorced with 10 days to spare. Thank you very much. But what ended up happening was, that was in July. What ended up happening was, in August, my father got diagnosed with brain cancer. And they told me at that point, they told the family at that point, give us 6 weeks to get us the radiation, and we'll give you a prognosis of what it's like. And that's the last time I remember praying before I got here. Had this idea in my head that there was a punishing God, that was a God who didn't love me, there was a God who was keeping score, that I had done a lot of really horrible things in my life, or so I thought. Turns out I was just pretty much a goofy person. But I thought I had done these really horrible, unforgivable things, and I just knew that God was not paying any attention to me. So I figured if he wasn't paying any attention to me, I wouldn't pay any attention to him, and it would be okay. You know, he'd go his way, I'd go my way, and everything would be cool. Well, then my father got sick, and all I could say was, please, God, just let him live. Please, God, just let him live. And on September 25th, 1997, my father passed away from brain cancer. And I knew at that point that the reason my dad had died was because God hated me. That's the idea of God that I brought into the program less than a year later. And I'm so grateful to Al-Anon today, because I can look back on those events today and be incredibly grateful for all that happened. My husband got an opportunity to meet my father. My father got an opportunity to meet and get to know my husband. Kent got to ask for permission to marry me, which was very important to my father. We have a relationship with my mother that we would not have unless we had the programs of Al-Anon and AA. My father did not suffer the entire time he was sick. He had one headache the whole time. My father was able to reconcile with his youngest brother that he had not seen in 25 years the day before he died. with his older brother, who was happened to be here from Holland. Now, I don't know how that happens, except God's in charge. God brought my father and my two uncles together for 6 hours the day before my father died. And I'm so grateful that I have a program that allows me to see that. I don't think God gives me anything because I'm in Al-Anon. I think God allows me to see everything because I'm in Al-Anon. And but what happened to me at that point was when my father died, I thought, that's it, I'm done with God. Not having anything to do with God. And I had a lot of prejudices towards God, higher power, any of that stuff when I got here. Kent and I pushed the wedding back to July. We got married on July 18th. And right before we got married, Kent said to me, my parents don't know I drink, which I thought was a little odd. He was 36. He is older than I am. And I said, okay. He said, so what we need, and this is an example of my insanity. My parents don't know I drink. He's 36 years old. I said, okay. He said, so we need to buy a refrigerator to put in the bedroom so that I can have beer in there. That made perfect sense to me. I know today, normal people, earth people, whatever you want to call them, they don't buy refrigerators and put them in the bedroom to hide the beer. That's a little weird. But you know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. That was in July. So I told you when we got here on September 18th, that's what I brought into the program of recovery. This idea that God hated me, this idea that I did not want a higher power, this idea that there was nothing wrong with me, that his not drinking wouldn't fix. So for 4 days into it, he comes home and he says, you need to do everything in Al-Anon that I do in AA, and that began the journey. And I will tell you, the first year was the hardest year of our recovery for me. He will tell you it was the best year of his recovery. Simply because he said, you know, you just needed some strong sponsorship, honey. I'm like, great, thank you. But what happened was he was going to a meeting a day for a year. I was going to an Al-Anon meeting because I had nothing else to do. Going to an Al-Anon meeting, his first sponsor, whom I didn't like then and I don't like now, turns out that's not a requirement, said you will have date night. And so we'd go to date night. Every Saturday night his home group would be an open speaker. We'd have dinner and we'd go to an open AA speaker meeting. And I'm so grateful for that because, you know, by the time I got here, once he told me 4 days in everything he'd lied to me about, I couldn't believe a thing he'd tell me. But people from Alcoholics Anonymous would stand up at a podium like this and share their experience, strength, and hope. And they'd tell me about the disease of alcoholism. And I'm so grateful for that because I could hear it from you all and I could not hear it from him. We weren't in very long before his sponsor said, you will go to this conference down at the beach. And I said to him, we can't possibly go to the conference down the beach, we're in debt. And I had this huge fear of financial insecurity. I have no idea where it came from, except I made it up in my head. And he called, and I was standing right there because I needed to be sure he said what I needed him to say to this guy that I didn't like. Corey says, we can't go to the conference. And the guy said on the other end of the phone, God love him, he said, you're already in debt. I don't care. You said you'd be willing to go to any lengths. And Ken hung the phone up, and he looked at me and said, I'm going whether you want to go or not, but I'd like for you to come with me. And I couldn't possibly allow him to go to this conference at the beach by himself. I had this idea in my head. Somebody described it once as the women in AA were wearing tank tops and cut-off shorts, and they were sitting on men's laps and wiggling. And I just knew that was what was happening. And there's somebody in here going, God, I wish I knew where that meeting was. I just knew that was what was happening. I had waited 36 years. I'd been through all this to get him. By God, you were not stealing him from me. So I had to go to keep an eye on him. And I went. I have no idea who the speakers were that I heard except for two. The first Al-Anon speaker I ever heard was Mary Pearl. Yeah, and she talked about drowning her husband in the bathtub. The first AA speaker I remember speaking was Clancy. Yeah, and he talked about electroshock therapy. And I was horrified. It's the only way I can describe it. I was absolutely appalled that people would stand up in front of a room full of strangers and tell these incredibly personal things, and they were taping it. Thank you very much. In my profession, we call that a confession. You don't do it without the Miranda warnings. It was awful. It was horrible. And we were sitting in the very front row, and I leaned over to Kent because he is at this point sponsoring me, and I said, what's the deal with sponsorship? And I heard a woman behind me. I swear it sounded like she was screaming at me, and I know what she said today was, get a sponsor. That's not what I heard. I heard her screaming at me, and then she got up and spoke, and it was Mary Pearl, and I was horrified that I had been called out by this woman who was speaking from the podium. It was a hideous experience, and I said, I would never, ever do that. Never say never. But what she did say to me, she said, pray about a sponsor. And I started praying for a sponsor. We weren't very long, I think maybe 2 months in, and Kent decided that he needed to start exercising. And because I am helping, because that's what I do, and because he's sponsoring me, and I don't have anybody in Al-Anon giving me any sort of direction whatsoever, I am going to help him get in shape. And that consists, and I, of course, forget I am dealing with an alcoholic. He says, I'm going to run 3 times a week, two miles a week. Two miles, 3 times a week. I can do that. That seems relatively easy. We buy a Walmart bike. Within a week, we're training for a marathon, which is 26 miles. And I'm riding with him, and he's a chatter. My husband's a chatter, and he's chatting at me. What step are you on? What are you doing? What are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. You know, and what ended up happening was this woman came from Oklahoma. Her name is Luana, and Luana is my sponsor today, and she has a sponsor, and her sponsor's name is Doris, and that's really important for me. Maybe not for you, but it is for me. And I remember the first meeting Luana was at. We were talking about the 12th step. I had about 6 months in, and it got around to me. We do the thing in the circle, and got around to me. And I said, well, I haven't worked any of the steps, but I am carrying the message. And we got around to Luana, and I don't know what she said, but I will tell you what I heard. What I heard her say was, honey, you are not carrying the message. You are spreading the disease. Shut up. And I know today she did not say shut up. She said the rest of it, but she didn't say shut up. I know that today. But that's what I heard, and I went home in tears. She'd hurt my feelings. And I got home, and I was boo-hooing, and Kent said, oh, my God, what are you going to do? I said, I think we're going to ask her to be my sponsor. I have no idea where that came from, but it was the wrong thing to say, because then he's really in my ear. When are you going to ask? 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 And you know, we plant seeds here without any idea that we're planting seeds. And we were out on a long run one morning. He's running, and I'm riding the bike, and he's asking, and I'm thinking, Mary Pearl tried to kill her husband. I think I'll just run him down with the truck. And so what I did was I whipped around on the bike, just left him out there, ran home on the bike, and I called Luana. I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, well, why me, honey? I said, because I'm going to kill him. I'm going to run him down with the truck. And she said, no, honey, why me as your sponsor? And I said then something I can only attribute to God is I said, I want what you have. And I couldn't have told you what it was except that she was happy with what she had. She would come to meetings and share about things that were going on, but she had joy and she had happiness and she had laughter and she had peace and she had serenity, and I wanted that. I'd been watching my husband change for about 6 months, and I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified because I was sure that once he changed enough, he was going to meet his perfect woman in AA. I did not know that he and I are perfectly well-suited for each other, but I didn't want to be me anymore. I was so sick of living the way I was living. I didn't like me. I had no idea who I was. I couldn't have told you what music I liked, what color I liked. I couldn't have told you any of that stuff when I got here. And so she said to me a very, very important thing, and I say it to the men and women that ask me if I'll sponsor them. She said, are you willing to do what I've done for as long as I've done it to get what I've got? And I said, yes. And I had no idea what I was agreeing to, but I said yes. And that woman took me through the 12 steps of Al-Anon, and she got me involved in service work, and she'd say things, honey, let's get in the car and go to this district meeting. Let's get in the car and go to Birmingham and go to their district meeting. There's a workshop here. Let's go there. Let's go hear these speakers. And she took me through those steps, and she started at the beginning, step one, and I did all 12 steps in order with the same woman. And that woman knows more about me than any other person on the face of the earth, including my husband today. And I'm very, very grateful to her for the willingness that she had to share with me what she had. And so when people ask me to sponsor them, I am more than happy to share with them what was so freely given to me. And we started doing the deal. And I started working the steps. And I started doing the service commitments. And I started, we got hooked on the CDs and the tapes early on. And we started listening to all these CDs and all these tapes. And we are rocking along. And I'm about 2 years in, and I'm working at a job that I absolutely despise. I cannot work the kind of program I want to work in that job. And I'm talking to my sponsor about it, and she's saying, pray about it. And, you know, I've got this whole thing about God, but all right, I'm willing to do it. So I'm starting to pray, and I'm listening to people talk about their God, and I'm taking a little bit of Sarah's God, and I'm taking a little bit of Kelly's God. I'm taking a little bit of Luana's God, and I'm making this idea of a God who I want, who I want to be able to turn my will and my life over to. And Kent came to me about 2 years in and says, I need to learn to be financially responsible. Well, you know, I've got the whole financial issue. I'm willing to give pretty much anything to God except the money, because I'm pretty sure that he's way too busy with, like, the Middle East to deal with my finances. So he can handle the Middle East. I'll handle the money. It'll all be good. And Kent came to me and said, I think I need to learn to be financially responsible. And I said, Okay, so we got him a little bit of credit card, and he maxed it out very quickly, and I got very afraid. And so we came up with a different plan. And this went on a couple of times in recovery, and at about 5 years, because I'm working with a sponsor, I am taking these things to her. I'm not taking them to Kent. And we came up with this idea that that Kent was going to have an allowance, and he could have the allowance. He could do with it whatever he wanted. I was not checking I would deposit the money into his checking account. I was not checking his account. I had no interest in what he was doing, and that seemed to be a good idea for us. And around this time, he came to me and he said, they're asking for civilians to voluntarily deploy overseas, and I really feel compelled to volunteer. And I said, well, let me pray about it. Let me talk to my sponsor about it. And I did that. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, Kent really wants to volunteer to deploy. And she said, all right, do you practice the traditions in your marriage? And I said, well, you know that I do. And she said, well, what does the fifth tradition say? And it says that, you know, we encourage and support the alcoholic, we practice the 12 steps ourselves, and we welcome and give comfort to newcomers. She said, well, if you support and encourage your alcoholic, how can you possibly say no? I said, well, when you put it that way, I don't guess that I can. Okay. So I went to Kent and I said, all right, fine. If this is something you want to do, I'll support you. That was in 2006. And we were doing the financial thing. And at the end of 2007, I had this 3-year financial plan when I got here that if we had not spent a dime on anything, including the mortgage, gas, power, anything, in 3 years, we would have been debt free. My plan. We were this close to my plan at 8 years in. But we were this close. And he came to me at the end of 2007 and said, I need to talk to you. I've gotten us into some financial difficulty. And I said, well, what do you mean, us? And he said, well, my credit has repaired itself. I've been getting credit card offers, and I've been accepting them. And I said, it's only money. We'll figure something out. Yeah, that's tremendous for us, because he almost fell off the couch, I almost fell off the couch. But what had been happening was, I'm watching what's going on in my house. I'm watching, I'm paying attention. And I'm talking to my sponsor about it, and I'm saying things are showing up at the house that he can't possibly be paying for. And one of the things that I talk about is the gun safe, the ginormous gun safe that ended up in the garage. And I asked him, wow, that's a really nice gun safe. How'd you get that? And he looked at me dead in the eye, and he said, I bought it on layaway. I mean, my husband, and I love my husband, he's never bought a thing on layaway and never would. I'm thinking, okay, something odd is going on. So I immediately called Luana and said, this is what he said. She said, you can interrupt this if you want, but if you do, he will never get where he needs to go. Okie dokie. And so I'm doing the work. I'm doing the inventory. I'm doing the praying. I'm doing the nightly review. I'm asking God. I'm putting in the God box. I'm working with people who are asking me to work with him. So when he came to me at the end of October and said, I've gotten us into some financial difficulty, and I said, it's only money. What are you willing to do differently? Because I'm not willing to keep going through this. And he made some changes in his program, and he ended up asking a guy from Southern California, Scott R., to sponsor him. And that was that began the change in our life. They talk about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. We got rocketed into the fourth dimension, and I had no idea it was going to happen. Now, I always share the amount of the money, because I know there's some Al-Anons in there wondering, well, you know, really, how much money is it? In 2 years, we were $42,000 in credit card debt. In 2 years. But I know today that was that was his alcoholism manifesting in financial difficulties. That's just the way it manifested in our house. And I will tell you today, it was a very, very small price to pay for the life that we have today and the recovery that we have today, because our lives have changed dramatically from that point in time. He got a new sponsor. I continued to do the stuff that I was doing, and things changed. And we came up with a financial plan. We came up with a budget. We figured out a way we were going to make it work. And we kept doing the things we've been taught to do in the program. I kept doing the service work. I wanted an early morning meeting. In Montgomery, all the meetings are at 6 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock at night, and I wanted an early morning meeting. And we started this 6:30 a.m. meeting on Tuesday and Thursday morning. It's called the First Things First Group, and if you're ever in Montgomery, please come and join us. Tuesday morning is a closed discussion meeting. Thursday morning is a literature meeting. And I had taken up exercise because, like I said, I'm not the woman I was when I got here, and I always liked the easier, softer way. And when I was having knee difficulties, I went to my orthopedic surgeon and said, I think it's time for a knee replacement. And he looked at me and he said, honey, there's nothing wrong with you that losing some weight won't fix. And I said, are you saying I'm fat? He said, yes, I am. Lose some weight. And you know, because I had enough time in the program, I was actually able to receive that information. And so I decided I decided I needed to lose some weight before I could join Weight Watchers, and then I joined Weight Watchers, and then... See, the thinking gets better, it doesn't get perfected. And then I had to start exercising, and we started running, and I could only run for 30 seconds when I started, and I did the running like I did Al-Anon, and I'd run for 30 seconds, and I'd walk for 30 seconds, and I used that time to talk to God, the God that I was never going to talk to again. And in 2009, I ran my first full marathon. Yeah, don't get too excited because I keeled over. Mile 21.23, apparently. I turned around to my husband and said, "You go ahead and finish, honey. I'm going to pass out now." And I did. I went over on the side of the road. And when I came to with the paramedics there, the first thing out of my mouth was, "I'm so sorry I failed." And he said to me, "You didn't fail." And I said, "I did fail." He said, "You didn't fail." And I knew then that there was more work for me to do. And I started doing the work. Now, I will report that I did go back and I ran that marathon again the next year, because I was getting my bling. It's a big old giant Mickey Mouse medal, and I was getting that medal. And all the people asked, "What do you want me to pray for?" I said, "Please, God, pray for cooler weather." And God listens to prayers, because when we start, the year I keeled over, it was 80 degrees and 100% humidity. The next year when we ran, it was 24 degrees when we started and 34 when we finished. Thank you. And I came in under 5 hours. And I ran with my dad's New York Marathon times written on the bottom of my shoes. So that's what Al-Anon's done for me in that regard. But so we had this conversation in October, and we went to an Al-Anon thing, and in January I came home. I was oozing Al-Anon, you know how it is, out of every pore in your body. I was just, Al-Anon was fabulous. And I opened the mail, and Kent had bought $34 symphony tickets. And I had a meltdown. I mean, there's no way to describe it except I was like Linda Blair from The Exorcist. My head spun around, and I turned into a complete and total crazy woman. And he looked at me and said, "I'm not willing to live this way." And I did the only thing I knew to do, which was put my running shoes on and go run down my street. And as I'm running, I'm talking to God. Now, I don't talk to God, but apparently I do now. And I'm talking to God, and I'm talking to God, and said, you gotta help. I don't know what I'm going to do. You got to help. And I heard as clear, this is the only other time I heard, beside the "you need to go to Al-Anon," heard as clear as a bell, "You're either in the marriage or you're not. Make a decision." Made a decision, I was in the marriage. And we haven't had an issue with the finances since. But we kept on the plan. We kept going. And in 2010, in June of 2010, on a Wednesday night, my husband was with my mother and I for dinner at our favorite steakhouse in town, and he looked at me and he said, "I don't think I'm going to get to go." And I said, "Well, go where, honey?" He said, "Well, you know, I've been applying for all these deployments." And I had completely zoned on the... I had no idea he was still applying for these deployments. And I said, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry." I was... Yes! See, all I had to do was be willing. I didn't actually have to do anything. I just had to be willing to let him go, and God was going to work it all out. God's got a sense of humor. Because Kent had been applying for deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that was on a Wednesday. Apparently, he got an email on Thursday. I got a phone call on Monday. And the phone call I got sitting at my desk on Monday afternoon was, "I'm going to Djibouti." And I said, "Where?" He said, "Africa." And I said, "Really? For how long?" He said, "A year." Okay. Now, this is where you know, the rubber hits the road. I've been saying I'm going to support and encourage him, and I'm going to support and encourage him. Now, God works in strange and mysterious ways. My sponsor is married to an Air Force colonel who's been on deployments, so I knew I could call her. And she gave me some very strong direction about things that were going to happen as this deployment got close. She would say to me, "You're going to see it in his eyes. He's going to be already gone. This is an adventure for him. This is an excitement for him. This is something he really wants to do. You are going to support him. You are not going to tear him down. You are not going to be whiny. You are not going to be cry. Yes, ma'am. Not going to do it." And Ken came to me in July and said to me, "I've been talking to a lot of people, and they say I have to be really, really clear about this, because this is something that we have to agree to together. Are you okay with me going?" And I asked him one question, and I said, "Is this part of your ninth step amends to the military?" And he said, "Yes, it is." I said, "Then go. I do not want to stand in the way of his amends process." And when people say to me, "How can you let him go?" My response to them is, "How can I not let him go? Why would I want to be the one to stand in the way of him making the amends that he needs to make? I love him enough to let him do it." But I thought that entire time, that entire year, was going to be about him and about what he needed to do and where he needed to go. He came home on August 10th and said, "I need to be on a plane in 10 days. To go to Africa." And I put my husband on a plane on August 30th, 2010, knowing I would see him one time in the next year. And I was afraid, because I didn't know if AA would be there. I did not know I knew I wasn't going to be there, but I didn't know what was waiting for him, and I was afraid. And God does incredible things for me. I didn't say out loud because I didn't want him to actually hear me, but I said I'd be willing to work with anybody who came to me that year. I'd be willing to go wherever God wanted me to go. And 2 days later, I was in a conference in Nashville, Tennessee, and I got to meet Jack C. for the first time there. And Jack stuck with me the whole weekend and helped me get through that first weekend without Kent. And Kent called me and said, I've landed in Djibouti and I'm in a tent with 60 guys. And I said, well, it sucks to be you because I'm in a junior suite with chocolate-covered strawberries. But it was the laughter. It was the laughter that kept us going that whole year. And we could Skype. And my sponsor said, you got to find something you guys can do together. And I said to Kent, we need to find something we can do together. And he said, well, I'm going to take up scuba diving lessons. I start on Monday. And I'm afraid of being underwater. And I'm like, oh, no, no, no. This was not what I had in mind. And my sponsor said, can you learn to scuba dive? I said, well, I guess I can. She said, go with God. Take God with you scuba diving. So I learned to scuba dive. And 6 months into the deployment, Kent and I met in Tanzania, Africa. And I got to go on an 8-day photographic safari. We got to fly from Arusha, Tanzania, to Zanzibar, and I got to scuba dive in the Indian Ocean. And if I had done what I wanted to do, which was let my fear guide me, I'd never had that experience. And it was an incredibly difficult year. I came back from Tanzania. I was not home 24 hours before. I was sitting on the couch, boo-hooing my eyes out, because I was sure the only reason I was in this horrible mess was because Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hated Alcoholics Anonymous because he would never have gone if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was just wallowing in the self-pity. And I hated Al-Anon because I'd never ever said yes if it hadn't been for Al-Anon. It was just awful. And I'm just going to sell everything and move to Colorado. I mean, I don't know where any of this stuff comes from, but so just boohooing on the couch. And I have enough program to know I was hungry, I was angry, I was lonely, and I was tired. And so I didn't call anybody. I didn't say anything I wasn't supposed to say. I waited until 7 o'clock, and I went to sleep. And Kent came back from that year being deployed, and our lives have never been the same since because he got to do what he needed to do. But what I learned about that whole experience was it was not about him at all. It was about me because the entire time I needed to be married to Kent. I needed him. I needed him to need me. And at the end of that year, I realized, I learned, I knew that I am enough. In and of myself, I am enough today. And that if he were to leave me tomorrow, it would break my heart and I'd be devastated. But I would be okay. Because today, I am sufficient for me. I am exactly where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing it. And I'm doing it with a God of my understanding who loves me and wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. I got my invitation to a personal, intimate relationship with the God of my understanding through the disease of alcoholism, and I don't have any fight with that. I don't ever want to live it again, but I don't have any fight with that. I have a relationship today with a God who absolutely knows my name. I have a relationship today with my husband that is beyond my wildest expectations. All I wanted when I got here was I wanted him to not drink as much. If I'd gotten what I wanted, I would have sold him short. I would have sold me short. I would have sold everybody short. I have relationships today. I am at a job that I absolutely love. My boss knows nothing about the disease of alcoholism except I've given him a big book and I've given him how Al-Anon works. And he believes that when I go and speak or when Kent goes to speak, that it's community service and he doesn't make me take vacation time to do it. That's a miracle in and of itself. I am able to say with every fiber of my being that I absolutely love my life today. Everything that I have in my life that is of value is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And if you are new, I would encourage you to please stay with us. Stay with us long enough to find a God of your understanding who wants you to be happy, joyous, and free. Thank you very much for having us. Thank you for my life.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.